I don't remember anything, the director said. Rund said, without looking up, My mind has been through the rigors of Mentat training. Maybe I have some ability to resist Bene Gesserit mind tricks. But you failed as a Mentat, Kinnis reminded him, his voice heavy with skepticism. Nevertheless, it changed the neural pathways in my brain. He remembered an adage from the school. Patterns tend to repeat themselves, for success or failure. My mind developed pockets of resistance, mental muscles, auxiliary storage areas. Perhaps that is why their coercion didn't take hold completely. His kindly old uncle would be proud of him. Balt scratched his scalp, as if trying to dig up any remaining roots of hair. I suggest we take the time to go over Chobin's laboratory again. The director looked impatient. We already did that after he defected. Chobin was just a low-level researcher from an unimportant family, so he did not have a very large space. We have used it for storage since his departure. Rund erased the sketches on his drawing screen. Without asking Kinnis for permission, he hurried toward the old work area. Inside the long abandoned laboratory, he stared at a list of requisitioned parts and fragments of notes. He went over administrative surveillance holophotos taken of Chobin, but nothing important presented itself. The renegade inventor had been altering classic Holtzmann equations developed millennia ago. The most brilliant modern scientists didn't completely understand how T.O. Holtzmann's esoteric formulae worked, only that they did work. Rund couldn't understand what Chobin had done either. His brain was afire, operating at a higher efficiency than he had imagined possible. Flinto Kinnis stood amidst the activity, doing his best to supervise, while Rund went over the entire laboratory space, ignoring the other people. He tapped floor plates, walls, and ceilings, every square centimeter. Kneeling at a juncture between the floor and the outer hull of the orbiting station, he noticed a crack that flashed in and out of view, a camouflaged portion, no more than a tiny flicker, a dust grain in the eye. Rund stared until his eyes ached, remembering how a stern Mentat teacher had taught him to observe. He sped up his perceptions, slowing down time, and caught the next flicker. At the precisely correct moment, Rund stepped through the wall. He found himself inside a claustrophobic alcove, smelling of metal and stale air. With another flicker, the wall sealed itself behind him. He could barely turn around in the tight room. Darkness crashed down, as if he had gone blind. His breathing became labored. Every surface was frosty. Fumbling in the blackness, he found thin sheets of Redulian crystal, plan screens, sugar-wire spools packed with data. He called out, but his words bounced back at him. He could not hear or see anything of the main room. When the wall flickered again, Rund stumbled out, unnerved but excited. Director Kinnis stared at him. It is a secret, shielded room, but the field seems to be breaking down. Chobin has left much information inside. Kinnis squeezed his hands together. Excellent. We must retrieve it. I intend to get to the bottom of this. He turned to one of the tall technicians. The moment another flicker occurs, go inside and bring out anything you find. The technician, poised like a hunting cat, chose his time perfectly and jumped forward to vanish into the wall. The room disappeared again. But as Rund and Kinnis waited in the old lab for minutes, then half an hour, the man did not come back out. They could hear no sound, nor could they pry open the alcove again, despite repeated pounding on the white structural plates. A work crew came in with cutting tools and ripped through the wall, but they found only the standard airspace between the station walls. Even scanners showed nothing unusual in the area. While the technicians grew more desperate, Aloha Rund stared off, his mind lost in a near-Mentat projection. Based on a variation of the Holtzmann equations, he assumed that the invisibility field had folded space itself in a ripple around the hidden chamber. When the opening flickered again and stayed open, the technician slumped back out through the opening, his face pale and eyes flat, his fingernails torn and bleeding, as if he had tried to claw his way out. Two men rushed forward to help him, but the technician was dead, apparently suffocated or frozen from his strange journey. Where had the flicker taken him? Afraid, no one moved to retrieve the data inside the still-open alcove, until Rund shouldered his way forward as if in a trance. Kinnis made only token protests, his eyes hungry for the cache of information. Expecting the barrier to phase back into place at any second, Rund tossed out plan screens, shigawire spools, sheets of Redulian crystal, while technicians scrambled to retrieve them. As if mentally attuned to the weird field generator, Rund stepped back into the safety of the laboratory, only moments before the wall phased back again, as solid as before. Talis Bault stared at the hoarded notes. It will require quite an investment to exploit this work properly. The dead technician, already forgotten, Director Kinnis looked as if he might be trying to decide how to take credit for the work. I will convince Premier Kalimar that we need extensive funding. Very extensive. Rund, you speak to Count Ilban. Between them, they should be able to figure out how to obtain a great deal of money. Revenge. Has language ever created a more delicious word? I repeat it to myself when I go to sleep at night, confident it will give me pleasant dreams. Baron Vladimir Harkonnen. The government of Rachiz needed a large but unofficial influx of Solaris in order to finance redeveloping Choban's invisibility field. And Premier Ein Kalimar knew where to get all the funds he wanted. He arrived on Gedi Prime, angry that he had to keep pressing for his long overdue payment from House Harkonnen. Instead of being taken directly to the looming keep, where he had always met the Baron before, Guard Captain Kriubi led Kalimar deep into the oppressive heart of Harko City. A thin man, fastidiously dressed, Kalimar steeled himself, trying not to lose his nerve. The Baron always played psychological games. The Premier had to finish these negotiations and survive them. For some unknown reason, the Harkonnen Lord had decided to inspect his waste recycling plants this morning, and the Premier was informed that the meeting must be conducted there or not at all. Kalimar wrinkled his nose at the thought of it. Inside the huge industrial building, the air was moist, warm, and redolent with odors that he would have preferred never to experience. Behind his gold-rimmed spectacles, his eyes stung. He could feel the stench permeating his synthetic fabric suit, and knew that this outfit would have to be burned once he returned to his plush offices in Triad Center. But he would not return without the money the Baron owed House Rachiz. "This way," Kriubi said, his firm lips adorned with a thin mustache. He led Kalimar up an endless series of metal steps to a network of catwalks. These high walkways overlooked pungent sewage vats, like sinister aquariums for bottom feeders. How did a man as fat as the Baron ever get up here himself? Kalimar panted most of the way, trying to keep up with the captain, and finally noticed metal lift platforms installed at convenient locations. So he is trying to put me in my place already. His nostrils narrowed, and he gritted his teeth to bolster his confidence. He would need to be tough and treat the Baron with firm determination. The first time fastidious Calamar had come to Gedi Prime, the Baron had calmly allowed him to sit in a room with an unseen dead body nearby. While the Premier had made his embarrassing request for quiet financial assistance, the odor of rot in the air presented an unspoken threat. This time, Calamar would turn the tables on the fat man. Years ago, the Baron had offered to help the faltering industries of Rachis on condition that he receive the secret ministrations of a Sukh doctor. Afterward, the Baron had paid only part of what he'd agreed, then subsequently ignored Rachis's repeated demands. The doctor, Wellington Yue, had been able to identify his patient's disease, but had no way of curing it. No one could do that. And so the Baron had used that as a justification to ignore paying the rest of the fee. But now, with Corona Director Flinto Kinnis's excited assurances that they would potentially develop an invisibility generator, Calamar needed large amounts of seed capital. The initial research work would be expensive, but with their rival Ix closed off and operating far below optimum capacity, Rachis had a chance to win back its powerful economic position. The Baron must pay what he owed, even if Calamar had to blackmail him into fulfilling his obligations. The Premier proceeded across the catwalk to where the enormous man tottered near the rails, high above the sewage vats. Kriubi told him to go forward alone, which made Calamar wary. "Does the Baron intend to kill me?" Such an action would cause an uproar in the Landsraad. No, House Rachis had too much damaging information on the Harkonnens, and their lord knew it. Calamar noticed that the Baron wore specially designed nose plugs and filters against the reek of the sewage plants. Without similar protection, the Premier didn't want to know how many toxins he might be inhaling with each breath. He removed his gold-rimmed eyeglasses and wiped the lenses, but an oily, streaky film remained. "Baron Harkonnen, this is an unorthodox place for our meeting." The Baron looked at the swirling currents of lumpy sludge as if he were peering into a kaleidoscope. "I have business to attend to, Calamar. We will talk here or nowhere." The Premier recognized the unspoken message, gross disrespect from a gross man. In response, he made his voice as gruff as possible. "Indeed, Baron. And as adults, as well as leaders of our respective world, we have obligations to meet. You, sir, have not met yours. Rachis provided the services you requested. You are obligated to pay the remainder of the agreed-upon fee." The Baron scowled. "I don't owe you anything. Your Sukh doctor didn't cure me." "That was never part of our agreement. He examined you and diagnosed your disease. You must pay." "I refuse," the Baron said, as if that ended the matter. "Now you may leave." Taking a deep breath that made him gag, the Premier pressed on. "Sir, I have repeatedly tried to be reasonable, but considering your criminal refusal to pay, I feel totally justified in altering the conditions of our agreement. Hence, I am upping the price." Calamar named an exorbitant sum of solaris and added, "Rachis is fully prepared to take the matter to Landsraad Court, where our law techs and attorneys will prove our case. We will reveal the origin of your disease and describe your continued degeneration and weakness. Perhaps we will even present evidence of a growing mental instability." The Baron's face purpled with rage. But before he could explode, they were interrupted by the arrival of three guards. They escorted a rangy man who wore exquisite, well-tailored clothes and billowing pantaloons. Mephistus Crewe did his best to ignore the alarming odors around him and stepped forward. You summoned me, my Lord Baron? He looked from side to side and frowned. Then, with a disapproving gaze, he looked down at the vat. The Baron shot a sidelong glare at Premier Calamar, then turned back to Crewe and said, I have a delicate question to ask you, a matter of decorum. His jowly face focused into an expression of deadly anger. I trust you can provide me with a satisfactory answer. The advisor stood straight and proud. Of course, my Baron, I am here to serve. Ever since the debacle of my gala banquet, I've been wondering, would it be polite for me to throw you into this sewage death trap myself, or should I have a guard do it, so that I don't dirty my hands? Crewe took an alarmed step away, as Creube gestured for the guards to block off his retreat. I don't understand, my lord. I gave you only the best. No clear answer, eh? Very well, I think I'll have the guards do it. The Baron motioned with a pudgy hand. That's probably the most polite alternative, anyway. Suddenly, the etiquette advisor could think of nothing civil to say. He screamed surprisingly foul words that even the Baron found offensive. Uniformed guards grabbed the rangy man by the arms and, in a smooth, mechanical gesture, swung him over the catwalk. Crewe's elegant garments fluttered as he fell. He managed to twist himself in the air before splashing into the deep vat of human waste. As Crewe struggled and kicked, trying to stroke his way through the quagmire of sewage, the Baron turned toward his shocked visitor. Pardon me, Premier, I wish to watch this and enjoy every moment of it. Coughing, Mephistus Crewe somehow made it to the slick, rounded edge of the vat, where he clutched the rim and vomited onto the clean floor, missing the sewage pond entirely. Guards wearing polymer gloves met him there and grasped his arms. When they hauled Crewe up over the rim, he wept with relief and terror. The advisor was sobbing, shaking, covered in brown slime and feces. He wailed up at the high catwalks, begging forgiveness. The guards attached small weights to his ankles and tossed him back into the stinking muck. Calamar watched these events with horror, but refused to be intimidated. I've always found it enlightening to witness the depths of your cruelty, Baron Harkonnen. He forced firmness into his voice, as the unfortunate victim continued to thrash below. Perhaps we can continue with more important matters. Oh, be silent a moment. The Baron pointed down at the flailing figure, surprised that Crewe still had enough strength to keep his head out of the goo. Calamar refused to be put off. Many years ago, Emperor Elrud ousted my master, Count Ilbenrachiz, from Arrakis because he appeared weak. When your own half-brother Abelard appeared weak, you removed him and assumed control of spice operations before Elrud could take action himself. The Landsrad and the Emperor have no fondness for impotent leaders. Once they learn of your debilitating disease and how it was inflicted upon you by a witch, you will become the laughingstock of the Imperium. The Baron's spider-black eyes turned to sharp obsidian. Below, the etiquette advisor sank beneath the sewage, but somehow emerged again to gasp a breath. He spat and coughed and splashed. The Baron was only too aware of how mercurial the Carino Emperor had been lately. Calamar had his rival by the testicles, and both men knew it. The Baron could rage all he wanted, but he had no doubt that the Richesians would do exactly as they threatened. In a conciliatory tone, he said, I cannot pay so much. Surely we can come to some more reasonable accommodation. We agreed upon a price, Baron, and you could have paid it at any time, but no longer. Now your own folly has increased the cost. The Baron choked on his reply. If I emptied all the treasury houses on Gedi Prime, I could never provide you with so many Solaris. Calimar shrugged. Mephistus Crewe's head was now submerged, but his arms flopped again. Even with the weights on his ankles, he managed to keep himself afloat for a few more agonizing minutes. The Premier made a final countermove. We have already filed our grievance in Lansrad Court. A hearing is set for 2 weeks. We can easily rescind that action, but only if you pay us first. The Baron scrambled for a solution, but knew he had no choice for now.
Spice! I can pay you in spice! I have enough Milan set aside to pay your damnable price, and I can provide it immediately. That should be a solid enough coin for a foul blackmailer like you.
Your insults mean nothing. The Harkonnen Griffin has no teeth. Calimar emitted a small laugh, then grew more circumspect. However, after the bloodbath on Zanavar and given Shaddam's continued threats against illegal spice stockpiles, I am hesitant to accept payment in that form.
It is the only way you'll get paid. You can accept melange now or wait until I acquire sufficient financing for an alternate form of payment.
The Baron flashed an insidious smile.
It may take months.
Very well. Calimar judged this was the best he could obtain, since his adversary needed to save face in some small manner. We will arrange for the secret transfer of your stockpile to our laboratory moon of Corona, where it will be guarded and kept safe. The Premier allowed himself to feel smug. I'm glad the matter is now over, though I am sorry to have to do this.
No, you're not, the Baron snapped.
He maintained a stony countenance.
Now get out of here, and don't ever try to blackmail me again.
Calimar did his best to conceal his nervousness as he negotiated the catwalk and scampered down the stairs. His insides roiling, the Baron resumed his concentration on Mephistus Crewe. This foppish man, so concerned with formalities and fancy perfumes, had surprising strength. It was admirable in a way. Even with the weights on his ankles, he still hadn't drowned. Finally, tired of the show, the Baron ordered Captain Kriubi to turn on the vat's chopper blades. As the thick, lumpy liquid began to swirl, Mephistus Crewe tried to swim even more frantically. The Baron only wished he could have added Premier Calimar to the mix. There are more tragedies in history than triumphs. Few scholars want to study a long litany of events that turned out well. And we Atreides have left more of our mark on history than we ever intended. Duke Paulus Atreides. Holding a wicked-looking dagger in his left hand and a shorter kidney stabber in his right, Duncan Idaho lunged at Leto. Scrambling backward into the banquet hall, Leto spun to cover his vulnerable spots with a shimmering half-shield. The swordmaster's reflexes had already slowed, adjusting the blade's speed so that the tip could slide through the dampening barrier. Leto surprised Duncan by making an unorthodox move. He threw himself directly toward his younger opponent. This increased the relative speed of Duncan's knife with respect to Leto's shield, and the blade skittered off the buzzing protective wall. Leto brought up his short sword, but the young swordmaster sprang out of the way, leaped atop the banquet table, and ran backward with cat-like grace. The faceted eyes of the stuffed Seleucid bull's head and the matador portrait of the red-garbed Duke Paulus seemed to watch the duel with interest.
"Those candlesticks were a wedding gift to my parents," Leto said with a laugh. "If you break them, I'll take the cost out of your hide."
"You won't be able to touch my hide, Leto."
Duncan performed a blatantly insulting backflip on the table. While the swordmaster was still in midair, Leto swept his dagger arm sideways, knocking down one of the long candlesticks himself and rolling it under Duncan's feet. The swordmaster lost his balance, sprawling on his backside. Jumping up onto the table, Leto ran forward, short sword in hand, ready to conclude this practice duel. It would be his first victory. But Duncan was no longer there. The swordmaster kept rolling and flung himself off the far edge of the table, then scuttled crab-like beneath the heavy furniture and sprang up behind Leto. The Duke backed off, facing his opponent, both of them grinning. Duncan jabbed with his knives, dancing on the fringe of the half-shield's protection. But Leto deftly parried with short sword and dagger. "You're distracted, Duke Atreides. You miss your woman too much." "Indeed I do, but I will never allow it to show." Their blade struck, skittered, scraping edge against edge. "Not even to you, Duncan." Leto fainted with the short sword, then brought up his fist, moving his bare hand through the shield and grabbing Duncan's loose green tunic just to prove that he could touch his opponent. Surprised, the swordmaster yanked free by slashing at Leto's eyes with the kidney stabber, coming close to touching, but not too close. Duncan sprang down onto a dining chair, tottering the heavy seat, but maintaining his balance as he stood on tiptoes. Through the doorway to the banquet hall, a servant entered with a tray of refreshments, her face open and innocent. Offhandedly, Leto gestured for her to leave them alone, and Duncan chose that moment to dive toward him. He did not use knives this time, instead crashing shield against shield to knock Leto to the tabletop. It was all the servant could do to scuttle back out of the banquet hall without dropping her tray. "Never heed distractions, Leto." Duncan caught his breath and backed off. "Your enemies will concoct diversions to make you focus your attention where it does not belong. Then they will strike." Panting, Leto lay back, felt the sweat trickling through his dark hair. "Enough! You've bested me again." He switched off his half-shield, and the swordmaster proudly sheathed his two blades, then helped the Duke to his feet. "Of course I've bested you," Duncan said. "But you tricked me a few times. Very interesting tactics. You're learning, sir." "Some of us can't afford to spend 8 years on Ginaz, and my offer still stands to bring your companion Hii Resser to Caladan. If he fights with half your skill, he would be a welcome addition to the guard at House Atreides." Duncan looked troubled. "I have heard only a little from him since his return to House Mauritani. I was afraid the Grummans might kill him when he got home, but he seems to have survived. I think he's now even part of the Viscount's personal guard." Leto wiped sweat from his brow. "Obviously, he's stronger and smarter than he was before. I just hope he isn't corrupted." "It's not easy to corrupt a swordmaster, Leto." Thufir Hawat stood at the doorway to the banquet hall, observing. Now that the training session was over, the Mentat stepped forward and gave a slight bow, his sinewy form making distorted reflections on the blue obsidian walls. "I concur with your swordmaster, my Duke, that you are becoming a better fighter. However, I would like to add my insight on tactics by reminding you that distractions and diversions can work both ways." Leto sat heavily on one of the dining chairs while Duncan set the toppled, undamaged candlestick upright on the table. "You mean, Thufir?" "I am your security commander, my Duke. My primary concerns are to keep you alive and to protect House Atreides. I failed you when I did not prevent the Skyclipper explosion, just as I failed your father in the bullring." Leto turned to look at the stuffed head of the monstrous, multi-horned creature that had killed the old Duke. "What you're going to say, Thufir? You do not want me to join the fighting on Ix. You'd rather I did something safe instead." "I want you to take the role of a duke, my lord." "I absolutely concur," Duncan said.
Romber must be physically present in the heat of battle so that the people can see him, but you need to face the Landsrad. Personally, I think that might be an even tougher fight.
Glowering, Leto looked at his two military advisers. My father was on the front lines of the Akazi revolt, and so was Dominic Vernius.
Those were different times, my Duke, and Paulus Atreides did not always heed advice.
Hawat glanced meaningfully up at the monstrous Seleucian bull's head.
You must make this a victory in your own manner.
Leto raised his short sword over one shoulder, holding the hilt loosely, as if he held a dagger, and hurled it. The blade spun in the air. The Mentat's hooded eyes widened, and Duncan gasped as the blade plunged into the bull's black, scaly throat. The sword had skewered the beast and stuck there, quivering.
You are right, Thufir. I am more interested in results than in grandstanding.
Pleased with himself, Leto turned back to his advisers.
We must make certain all the Imperium learns the Atreides lesson of Beakal. No warning, no mercy, no ambiguity. I am not a man to be trifled with.
There are no facts, only observational postulates in an endlessly regenerative hodgepodge of predictions. Consensus reality requires a fixed frame of reference. In a multi-level, infinite universe, there can be no fixity, thus no absolute consensus reality. In the universe, it appears impossible to test the reliability of any expert by requiring him to agree with another expert. Both can be correct, each in his own inertial system.
Bene Gesserit, Ajar Book.
In Lady Anirul's wing of the Imperial Palace, Reverend Mother Mohiam glided into Jessica's apartment without knocking. Sensing the older woman's presence, Jessica looked up from the roll-top desk, where she had been writing in the bound parchment journal Anirul had given her. She laid her ink plume down and shut the volume.
"Yes, Reverend Mother. A fact has just been brought to my attention by our operative Tesha," Mohiam said in the tone of a displeased schoolteacher. It was a voice Jessica had heard many times from the Proctor Superior. Mohiam could show compassion and kindness when she was pleased with her student, but she was also ruthless. "We waited for you to conceive an Atreides daughter pursuant to your orders. It is my understanding that you have been the Duke's lover for 3 years. 3 years gave you ample opportunity to become pregnant. I can only presume that you intentionally refused our instructions. I would like to know why." Though her heart lurched, Jessica locked onto Mohiam's gaze without wavering. She'd been expecting this, but still she felt like a little girl again, crushed by the disappointment her teacher had always been able to wield.
"I am sorry, Reverend Mother."
As Jessica watched the wrinkled lips move, she remembered how Mohiam had observed her, studied her every movement as she tested her with the deadly Gom Jabbar, the poison needle, the box of pain. With that needle at Jessica's neck, Mohiam could have killed her in a fraction of a second.
"You were ordered to bear a child. You should have allowed yourself to become impregnated the first time you slept with him."
Jessica managed to keep her voice firm, without cracking or stammering.
"There are reasons, Reverend Mother. The Duke was bitter about his concubine Kylea, and suffered many political problems abroad. An unexpected child at that time would have been a great burden upon him. Later, he was distraught over the death of his son Victor."
The older woman showed no sympathy whatsoever.
"Upset enough to alter his sperm count? You are a Bene Gesserit. Surely I have taught you better than this. What were you thinking, child?"
"Mohiam has always been expert at manipulating my emotions. She is doing it now." Jessica reminded herself that the sisterhood took pride in understanding what it meant to be human. What more human act could I have committed than to bear a child for the man I love? She refused to back down, speaking in a way that was sure to take her old teacher by surprise.
I am not your student any more, Reverend Mother, so you will kindly not address me in such a condescending manner.
The response took Mohiam aback. She stood silently. The Duke was not ready for another baby, and he had access to his own contraceptive measures. Not a lie, just a diversion.
I am pregnant now. What is the point in chastising me? I can have as many daughters as you like.
The Reverend Mother emitted a harsh laugh, but her face grew gentler.
Headstrong girl.
She backed out the door, a mixture of emotions playing across her face. She took a calming breath and glided away down the hallway. Her secret daughter had a stubborn, defiant streak. Mohiam decided it must be from the Harkonnen blood in her veins. In the dry, artificially cooled air of the residency at Arakeen, Lady Margaret Fenring watched with the sharp eyes of a Bene Gesserit as the Fremen housewoman methodically packed things for the extended trip to Kaitain. The woman, Mapes, had no sense of humor and virtually no personality, but she worked hard and followed instructions. "Bring my Imian rose dresses, the peach and saffron wardrobe, and the full lavender gown for regular daily appearances at court," Margaret commanded. "So those transforming silk film garments for the knights after Count Fenring returns from his business trip." As she spoke, she concealed a slip of imperial parchment from the eyes of her servant.
"Yes, my lady."
Without a smile or a scowl, the dried husk of a woman folded the slippery, sexy undergarments and packed them with all the other items for Margaret's departure to Kaitain. Almost certainly, this hardened desert woman understood much more about Lady Fenring than she let on. Years ago, in the dark of night, Mapes had led her to a hidden siege in the mountains, taking her to see their Sayadina, the Fremen equivalent of a reverend mother. Afterward, the entire siege had disappeared. Mapes had never said another word about the incident and avoided all questions. Now Count Fenring had departed again, and Margaret knew her husband had secretly gone to the closed world of Ix, though he believed she kept all of his furtive movements and errands hidden from her. She let him maintain his little delusions because it strengthened their marriage. In a universe of secrets, Margaret kept many of her own, too. "Have an early dinner prepared," Margaret ordered, "and be ready to depart with me in 2 hours." Her sinewy arms straining, Mapes sealed the fully packed suitcases and lifted them toward the door without using the attached suspensers.
"I would prefer to remain here, my lady, rather than taking the journey across space."
Margaret frowned at her, brooking no further discussion. "Nevertheless, you shall accompany me. Many ladies at court will be curious to see a woman whose every breath, every meal, has been impregnated with spice. They will see your blue within blue eyes and think them pretty."
Mapes turned away.
"I have work to do here. Why should I waste time with pretentious fools?"
Margaret's laugh was light.
"Because it would do the courtiers good to see a woman who knows how to work. Now that will be an exotic sight for them."
Scowling in response, the house servant trudged off with the two suitcases. When Mapes had passed out of sight, Margaret again touched the slip of imperial parchment that had been sent to her by courier. She ran her fingertips over the uneven coated bumps, searching for further subtleties in the brief message from Lady Anirul.
"We need your eyes here in the palace. Jessica and her baby were nearly killed in an assassination attempt on the Emperor. We must keep them safe. Make excuses, but come quickly."
Margaret slipped the note into a pocket of her dress, then busied herself with final details. Politics is the art of appearing candid and completely open, while concealing as much as possible, states the Bene Gesserit view. Since his appointment as Imperial Spice Minister, Count Hasimir Fenring had spent more time aboard Highliners than ever before. He'd left Margit in Arakeen that very morning, where she had been packing for a vacation on Kytane. He indulged his lovely wife in her little holidays and pleasure trips. But Fenring had important work to do, taking care of the Emperor's business. On Ix, Haidar Fen Ejidika should have everything completed by now, ready for the most vital test of all. During these tedious trips with all their stops and delays, Fenring kept his deadly skills honed. Only a few moments ago, in the frigate's private ablutions room, Fenring had pulled on black gentleman's gloves, locked the door, and strangled one of the irritating Waku vendors. "There is great skill in concealing one's hostility," an ancient sage had said. How true that was. Fenring had left the single-suit-clad body in a sealed toilet enclosure surrounded by the Waku's own overpriced, poorly made souvenir products. No doubt when another attendant discovered the corpse, he would take the trinkets and try to sell them to some unsuspecting passenger. His frustrations sated for now, the Count rode a shuttle through misty clouds down to Ix, accompanying a few traders and approved suppliers of industrial resources. The small ship landed amidst the heavily guarded bustle of the new Xuta spaceport, a large open overhang on the edge of a canyon. Standing on bilious yellow tiles, Fenring sniffed the distinctive odor of many Tleilaxu. He shook his head in dismay. The construction skills of the gnome men were woefully lacking, and evidence of inept workmanship was abundant. A public address system announced the arriving and departing shuttles. A few much taller outsiders delivered supplies and dickered with research managers over price structures. No Sardaukar were visible. The barricades, Fenring shouldered two Tleilaxu masters out of his way, ignoring their protestations, then skirted a puddle of water beneath a dripping rock ceiling. After he entered his high-level access codes and proved his identity, rushed messages were dispatched to the research complexes below. Fenring didn't hurry. Haidar Fen Ejidika would not have time to hide everything. Inside the deep access tunnels, he smiled broadly as a Sardaukar officer hurried toward him, his black and gray commander's uniform in disarray. "We did not expect you, Count Fenring." Leader of the Imperial Legions, Commander Kando Garon, raised an arm as if to salute the Spice Minister. Instead, Fenring grabbed the officer's beefy hand and shook it briskly with one of the gloved hands he'd used to strangle the vendor. "You should never expect me, Commander Garon, but you should always be prepared for me, The soldier accepted the slight rebuke with grace and turned to escort the Emperor's man toward the deep facilities.